Start by saying thank you for having me. I've really enjoyed every moment until this minute. It was going good for me. So this paper is a first attempt. It's a preliminary attempt to explore how an influential theory of emotions, affect theory, which has its roots in human psychology, conceives of animals. I'm interested in this because affect theory has a reputation for being pro-animals, not only in the social sciences and humanities, but also in some parts of the animal sciences, and especially ethology. This almost uniformly positive association between affect and animals has made me wonder, and I'm not the first person to wonder this, whether the biology that underpins it isn't really a helpmeet for a political project. So clearly, affect theory does a lot of conceptual and political work. For example, it enables social and cultural theorists to foreground the affective body in the organisation of individual and collective lives, and in this way to displace the privileged role that's attributed to language and reason in the constitution of the polis. It invites an ethics based not on abstract rights or moral principles, but rather on non-cognitive affective relations. And as this extract further implies, affect theory also challenges notions such as boundedness and interiority, which underpin a Western concept of the subject. And that concept is as troublesome to animals as is the Cartesian model of animals as machines. So I fully appreciate and share this agenda. Like Margaret Wetherill, though, I don't think that the politics of it renders the biology trivial. So I'm going to argue here that the biology of affect constitutes animals, whether explicitly or by implication, as a passive channel through which other forces act. And I've taken this theme of passivity from Vinciane Desprez's History of the Relations Between Emotions and Passivity in her book Our Emotional Makeup. In the long version of this talk, I build on that work in quite some detail. For the sake of brevity, I'm going to cut it out completely. So there is a subtext of passivity and so on, which I'm not going to discuss. It will just be there. So I'll do two things in this paper. First, I'll draw on Ruth Lees's book, The Ascent of Affect, to sketch out two basic tenets of affect theory as they're developed in human psychology, as they play out in social and cultural theory, and as they are relevant to animals. And then in the second part of the paper, I'll address Franz de Waal's most recent book, Mama's Last Hug, which is a contemporary iteration of affect theory and also a challenge to it. So affect theory. Affect theory is based on a theory of emotions commonly known as basic emotion theory. As Lees explains it, there exists a small set of basic emotions defined as pan-cultural categories or natural kinds. What these emotions are and how many there are is a matter of debate, but they usually include fear, anger, sadness, disgust, joy, and surprise. And one might note that only emotions that show in the human face qualify or can qualify as a basic emotion theory, as a basic emotion. So love, for example, is not a basic emotion because it apparently doesn't show in the human face. These emotions, Lees continues, are evolved, genetically hardwired, reflex-like responses of the organism. Basic emotion theory is a continuous theory insofar as the anatomical structures and neural networks that constitute the substrate for these basic or primary emotions are believed to be shared by both animals and humans. The continuity ends there, however, since only humans, affect theorists claim, experience the so-called secondary emotions, such as pride, shame, and envy. The reason animals don't share experience secondary emotions is because they're thought to involve some element of cognition. Basic emotion theorists believe that emotions and cognition are mostly served separately by the brain, and that cognitive structures, unlike emotional structures, are not homologous in humans and most animals. And indeed, many of the key proponents of affect theory, Lees writes, go out of their way to avoid attributing cognition, agency, or intentionality to animals. But while the distinction between primary and secondary emotions is certainly of interest in itself, particularly as it maps onto and maintains an animal-human hierarchy, it's in relation to intentionality that its implications are really evident. So intentionality. When a person says, I'm sad because I've lost my necklace, they're directing that emotion, sadness, towards an object or situation that is understood cognitively. They give their sadness a reason. This is what it means to say that emotions have intentionality or meaning. For affect theorists, by contrast, the affects are completely free of inherent meaning or association to their triggering source. There is nothing about sobbing that tells us anything about the steady state stimulus that has triggered it. Sobbing itself has nothing to do with hunger or cold or loneliness. So stripping emotions of intentionality is an attractive feature of affect theory for many social and cultural theorists, Lees argues, because it opens up a space for contingency and error in emotional life. In other words, contingency and error become the starting point for novel understandings of the subject and the social world. Rather than rush headlong into the worlds that affect theory opens up, I think it's worth pausing to consider what's at stake for animals in this conceptual shift from intentionality to contingency. For if it is the case that we have essentially inessential relations with objects, i.e. contingent and arbitrary relations with objects, then how exactly, by what specific modes or means, do we humans establish our delusional relationships with them? And delusional is Ruth Lees's word, and by it she means relations that are believed to be meaningful but which are not. And how do the relations that animals establish with objects differ from these erroneous human ones? So the next line in this quote reads, only the fact that we grow up with an increasing experience of sobbing lets us form some ideas about its meaning. And this claim, I think, is indicative of a casual but nonetheless pervasive use in affect theory of ideas or some such cognitive equivalent to explain how humans establish an ostensibly delusional intentionality. Nigel Thrift, for example, foregrounds cognitive processes like imitation and suggestion, which he argues can be deployed to organize affects to powerful political effect. So Thrift argues that the illusion of love is created through affective appeals, the affective appeal of symbols, images, flags, music, and so on. The emphasis on ideas or cognitive processes as a way to dismiss intentionality is particularly troubling insofar as animals historically have not been considered to be able to form ideas. In fact, a long history of theories of animal behavior has worked hard to explain how animals understand their worlds, given that they don't form ideas about them. One majoritarian claim to have emerged out of that history is that in place of ideas, animals form associations. Associationist theories are interesting because they don't dispute that animals have relations with objects, but they do expose those relations as the product of accident, learning, or training. As in affect theory, then, these relations are also essentially contingent and arbitrary. But there's an important difference. A delusional idea may matter nonetheless, as Nigel Thrift's work shows, while an idealess association has no moral, political, or other significance. So if you consider, for example, the film White Dog, in which a German shepherd is conditioned first to attack black people and then to attack white people, it would be hard to argue that the dog is racist, Benedict de Boisseron argues, since the dog is only, she writes, an accessory to racial discrimination. The associations that the dog makes and remakes cannot be considered political in themselves, precisely because, unlike the illusion of love in Thrift's example, they are merely associations and not ideas about associations. Conditioning or training as explanations for animal behavior also confirms that animals have little or no intentionality towards objects or situations. When the gorilla Binti Dua saved a 3-year-old boy who'd fallen into the primate exhibit, many scientists, Duval observes, accounted for her actions by recalling the parenting skills and fetch training she'd received from humans. Similarly, Porcher and Schmidt argue that animal labour is barely conceived of as labour at all, because the collaborations of animals, to quote, is based on the theory of conditioning, that is, the training by the human of the animal. Both Duval and Porcher offer alternatives. Duval proposes that Binti Jewer's actions could have been an act of caring, while Porcher argues that cows do more than simply function, they invest their intelligence and their affects in the world. In other words, unlike associationist theories of learning, they assume that animal actions are meaningful to animals in their own ways. So as well as supporting a rather conventional conception of what's exceptional about humans, the ability to form ideas, affect theory also seems to lend theoretical justification to well-worn and rather dismal accounts of animal attachments in which nothing is at stake, nothing is at risk, and nothing is dangerous. And rather than develop that notion of danger, which I do in the longer version of this paper, I'm going to move straight on to Duval's challenge to affect theory. Do you know how long I've had?
You've had about 10 minutes.
Am I going really fast?
No.
Okay. There's so much in Duval's work that's good for social and cultural theorists. His materialist conception of mind, his challenge to reason, his theories of emotional contagion, and his emphasis on the social dimension of emotions. And note, by emotions, in this book at least, Duval means affects, but he says he prefers not to use that term. What's especially interesting to me is the explicit pop he takes at basic emotion theory. All emotions, he writes, are biological and essential. None is more basic than the others, and none is uniquely human. Emotions are like organs, he says, and since no human organ is new to evolution, the possibility, if not likelihood, of secondary emotions in other species cannot be dismissed. More important, I think, than Duval's conception of what emotions are, however, is his conception of what they do. Emotions for Duval provide a flexible interface between mind, body, and environment. And the importance of this flexibility shouldn't be underestimated, for it's his position that the world cannot be fully understood, or at least not consciously, by any of us. Our blind attraction to those in trouble, for example, which Duval calls pre-concern, and our intention to make life better for others, pre-sociality, are not merely affects. They are affects that serve to, quote, evolutionary goals that are often unknown to individual actors. To the extent that Duval understands emotions as evolutionary causes that act on or through the animal, to quote Eileen Crist, he implicitly constitutes animals as quasi-automatons. And I draw attention to that concept with regret because Crist develops it in her analysis of classical ethology and with its rather negative implications for images of animals. And it's precisely this European tradition that Duval identifies as his own inheritance and of which he is so critical throughout the book. Nevertheless, it remains that for him, emotions are not just at the interface of mind, body, and environment. They are drivers of minds and bodies in the environment. In fact, Duval draws a comparison between robots in affective computing, which are being equipped with action-oriented internal states, and the evolutionary equipping of living creatures with emotions. This, he argues, is the best way to organize behavior. Sometimes, however, Duval writes, it's better to ignore emotions or steer our behavior in different directions. And feelings are one such steer. And insofar as this suggests that they are a less passive passion than emotions, they're worth considering in a bit more detail. Duval understands feelings in two ways. The first is fairly conventional. Feelings are the private subjective evaluation of emotions or affects, and as such, they can show cultural variation. The second understanding is rather more intriguing. On the last page of Mama's Last Hug, Duval writes, "It's possible that feelings, instead of being a fancy byproduct, are an essential part of the emotions. After all, organisms need to sort out which emotions to follow and which ones to suppress or ignore. If becoming aware of one's emotions is the best way to manage them, then feelings are part and part of emotions, not just for us, but for all organisms. And Duval's thoughts on this, as he says himself, are speculative. And one symptom of this is that he develops a number of related ideas, all of which connect to feelings, without trying to organise them into a coherent theory. And I'll just give you an example of that. So an example of this kind of clustering of ideas can be found in the largest block of pages referenced to the word feelings in the index of the book. When the reader turns to these 19 pages, which constitute the major part of a chapter called Emotional Intelligence, they find that this word feeling rarely, if ever, arises. Instead, this chapter, the section of this chapter, offers evidence for two very weighty topics, the relations between emotions, rationality, and morality, and free will. And what unites these two topics are the conjoined issues of forward-looking cognition and self-imposed restraint, or in other words, appraisal. Appraisal is the filter, Duval writes, of experience and learning through which emotions always run. It's the means by which animals exercise control of their emotions in the face of consequences of which they may or may not be aware. Your cat snatches meat from your kitchen counter only after you turn your back. This, Duval writes, is what I mean by emotional intelligence. Now, Duval supplies a number of really wonderful examples in these pages that could certainly lead the reader to conclude that many animals exercise some form of free will. And this view would be further confirmed insofar as Duval makes clear his strong opposition throughout the book to the prejudice that only animals are able to control their emotion, only humans, sorry, are able to control their impulses, and to quote, that animals have few emotions and are unable to disobey them. The reason for his opposition to this prejudice, however, suggests that animals feel, not under the sign of their own experiences, or if they do, they are only the most limited experiences, but rather under the sign of evolution and adaptation, to which feelings are purposed through and through. Animals cannot be at the mercy of their impulses and instincts, Duval writes, because this would put them at evolutionary risk. Nothing could be less adaptive for an organism than to blindly follow its own emotions. Who wants to be a loose cannon? So at the end of this chapter on emotional intelligence, Duval writes, "This work has taught me that in addition to studying the emotions of animals, we should also explore how animals manage them." And this, I think, gets to the nub of what feelings are for Duval. They're a mechanism, possibly one of several mechanisms, most of which have a cognitive element, through which animals manage their emotions or sort out which emotions to follow and which ones to ignore. I wish that the early ethologists had thought of emotion-based reaction instead of clinging to the instinct concept, which is now largely outdated. Emotions, he writes, operate like intelligent instincts. In the context of the book overall, then, these pages, indexed to the word feelings, are essentially revealed to be about how short-term appraisals yield long-term evolutionary results. And it's significant that Duval proposes that research into specific forms of self-regulation, i.e. specific forms of feelings, would shed light not only on individual animal personalities, but may also, to quote, reveal key differences between species. Finally, it begins to make sense why in a chapter that ostensibly illustrates that animals exercise free will, Duval should observe of himself that personally, I am not a big believer in free will. In Mama's Last Hug, the passions brim with force and vitality, but this is the vitality of evolution, not of animals. And building on Chris's notion of mechanomorphism, I'd go so far as to frame Duval's understanding of the meaning animals make of the world through their feelings as a kind of mechano-meaning, by which I mean meaning that appears to belong to the animal, but which is in fact the property of some other driving force. Final slide. So I've basically argued that although affect theorists are often on the side of animals, and I truly believe that they are, the conceptual scaffolding that supports affect theory doesn't serve animals very well. Affect theory tends to conceive of animal passions as if they were lived by animals in the third rather than the first person, as something that happens to it. Florence Burgat, from whom I take the distinction between first and third person experiences of animal lives, would undoubtedly go further. For her, no theory that is based on a continuity between animals and humans can be good for animals. This is because the commonality with which these theories begin, no matter how far it extends biologically, theoretically, or politically, ultimately serves as a lure to measurement, to the measurement of the differences between animals and humans at best, and to the measurement of animals against humans at worst. Continuism and animal-human dualism, she writes, are hardly mutually exclusive. Perhaps one might argue that de Waal's impatience with rationality, at least when it comes to morality, reverses the animal-human hierarchy. Moral principles acquire their force, de Waal claims, from emotions, and no amount of abstract reasoning can be a match for them. De Waal isn't an advocate of what he calls bottom-up morality, and insofar as animals are closer to the bottom, they appear to be more moral. What they gain in moral, or perhaps evolutionary righteousness, however, they pay for with their ownership of experiences and meanings. I mean ownership in inverted commas, it's another discussion. Finally, I'm in agreement with Dominique Listel, who argues that ethology constitutes a veritable revolution, a forgotten revolution. I also think, like him, that ethology doesn't go far enough. The political value attributed to these sciences of emotions may challenge the transcendence of reason, as Rosie Brodotti writes of de Waal's work, but it doesn't challenge the transcendence of humans. Man is not an animal like any other, Bergat writes, because no animal is like any other. And this, to me, represents a better starting point from which to think about animals' relations with humans and other animals.